Bonjour, this is your Sunsounds volunteer reader, Ellen, welcoming you to this episode of Bon Appetit. The first article I'll be reading is Late Night in the Kitchen. Consummate entertainers, CBS late night hosts Stephen Colbert and wife Evie are publishing a cookbook of their kitchen escapades that doubles as a master class in couples therapy, written by Pervez Shalwani. As partners in life and work, comedian Stephen Colbert and his wife of 30 years, Evie McGee, are in the funny business, so it makes sense that their kitchen escapades are bound by humor as well. The two grew up blocks from each other in Charleston, South Carolina, but didn't meet until they were adults. During the pandemic, they discovered the kitchen was a place where they could collaborate. Confined to their South Carolina home with their three full-grown children, homemade meals turned into a big source of entertainment. The result is, does this taste funny? Their September release cookbook that is as much recipe Rolodex. It's full of both family hand-me-downs and new discoveries, as it is a masterclass in couples therapy. We caught up with the duo just ahead of that day's taping of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert to chat about the importance of having fun while cooking, Stephen's dream of getting the Pope to do a cooking segment, and a relatable fiasco. They refer to it as the spoon story in their book, from their first days as newlyweds that has shaped their roles in the kitchen, a story they have come to laugh about all these years later. You two come across as having fun when cooking. How do people have more fun with food? Evie, as a recovering insecure cook, I think you just have to relax. You just have to not take it so seriously. I always take it way too seriously. The thing that I've learned working on this cookbook is how forgiving a recipe can be, because I'm a rule follower, and that is the opposite of Stephen. Stephen, drinking wine while you're cooking helps a lot. Seriously, remember to drink it because sometimes you'll get stuff on your hands and you're like, I don't want to touch the glass because it gets the glass dirty. Get the glass dirty, and then play music. Play music, drink wine, and don't worry about it. Just have a good time. The book reads like a public display of couples therapy. Stephen, we say this at the front of the book, but this really did come out of COVID for us. We've never worked together before, and very specifically, did not work together, because what if working together wasn't good? What did it mean for our relationship? Evie, he's used to being the boss. It's a problem. Stephen, it's a real problem. But during COVID, she was my only crew and my only audience. So if I needed somebody to do a bit with me, ever, I'd be like, please welcome my stage manager and my sound designer and my entire crew, Evie, my wife. Thank you for joining me. And we had a great time. For 15 months, that was it. And then when we were asked if we wanted to do a book, we said, well, yeah. It turns out we like working with each other. And that was a really nice revelation to us. Do you remember when you first cooked together? Stephen, you're not going to tell the spoon story, right? I want to hear the spoon story. You hint at it in the book, but stop short of telling it. Stephen, if it helps, we both feel terrible about this story. Evie, we got married in Chicago. We were living in Chicago. It's exciting. Newlyweds. I don't even remember what I was cooking. For our wedding, someone gave us a series of nonstick pots. Stephen, beautiful, heavy, Calphalon nonstick pots. Evie, they were trendy at the time. This is 1993. I'm making something, and I use a metal spatula. Stephen, a metal spoon to scrape the bottom of the pan. Evie, Stephen said, I think we have to nullify the marriage. I don't think I scraped the pan, but the concept was that I could have. He said, we gotta have a conversation right now about spoons and pans. So what did I take from that? Never be in the kitchen with Stephen again. Stephen, but this book is a miracle. It's a miracle that we managed to do this book together. Evie, I'm not cooking with this asshole. He's gonna be all mean to me every time I do something. Stephen, this is why I don't like her telling the spoon story. She says it makes her look stupid, but we all know it makes me look like a complete fool. It's only taken 30 years. Dinner parties are a big part of your lives. Is there a dream dinner party guest? Stephen, the Pope would be fun. I did the voice for the book on tape for his memoir this spring. The Vatican called and asked, hey, Would Stephen read the Pope's book on tape in English? It's a memoir of his young life, and he talks about learning to cook from his mom and his dad and his grandmother. They're Italian. They live in Argentina, but their home language was Italian, and their food is Italian. His tortellini in brodo, like in broth, evidently was a big hit with all the seminarians. I really would not only want to have the Pope for dinner, but my dream is to have him on the show for a cooking segment. And if we get to religion or faith, that's fine, but we're going to do his tortellini. I think he might even go for that because it'd be so refreshing. Everybody wants to talk about Jesus with me, but why not my tortellini? Stephen, when you have food guests on the show, are they aware of your cooking prowess? Stephen, prowess is a strong word. I have fun. When you have a cooking guest on the show, the point is not really to cook. The point is for this to be entertaining for the audience, and if they get the recipe out, that's great. Daniel Boulud is very fun to have on. Jose Andres is very fun to have on. Ina Garten is fun. Allison Roman. But there's no one messing with Martha Stewart. Trying to get in the way of her ability to finish the recipe is one of my great joys in life, because she takes it really well, and she dishes it back and couldn't be more enjoyable. Does This Taste Funny? By Stephen Colbert and Evie McGee Colbert. Low country classics, family favorites like shrimp paste, think pâté, a Christmas beef Wellington, and even more to laugh about. $25, Amazon.com. Next I'll be reading 450 Days of Seaweed. After I gave birth to my daughter, Miyakuk was the brothy comfort I needed. By Hannah Osbrink. 450. That's the number of consecutive days I ate the same soup. Maybe it was more. I ate it in the morning. I ate it in the evening. I ate it, hands cupped around the bowl, on the most frigid of winter days. And I ate it with sweat-beaded brows on the most sweltering of summer ones. I never ate it in a box or with a fox, but almost always I ate it still in pajamas. Doesn't that count for something? Miyakuk, or Korean seaweed, miyak, soup, guk, holds great significance in Korean culture. Legend has it whales and dolphins eat lots of seaweed after giving birth. Koreans traditionally eat miyakuk for several months postpartum, as it's believed to purify the blood and encourage and enhance breast milk production. Beyond this time, miyakuk is a birthday soup for Koreans, meant to be consumed for breakfast with a steaming bowl of rice as an homage to their mothers for giving birth to them. After I had my daughter, my mother brought a thermos of homemade miyakuk to the hospital, my first taste of non-cafeteria food. During those ensuing days and sleepless nights of recovery, miyakuk served as a constant. While my bleary-eyed, bloated, still bleeding self was waiting for my milk to come in, while riding the hormonal roller coaster into the world of the new normal, I could at least rely on starting each day with the same meal. Miyakuk, bap, and if my mother was around, any assortment of banchan. If she wasn't, just the soup and the rice, and maybe some non-spicy kimchi. This isn't a common length. As custom dictates, I could have stopped eating miyakuk after just a few weeks or months, but I made the tradition my own, committing to the ritual for as long as I breastfed my daughter. It was the comfort I needed when my mother was back in Korea, my husband back at work, and I was left alone to figure out how to stay nourished and keep my tiny new nugget alive. Whether or not you're compelled by the lure of sea mammals enjoying a bounty of seaweed post-delivery, the fact is seaweed or sea kelp is highly nutritious, believed to be a rich source of iron, calcium, and vitamins, while also low in calories. Dried varieties keep in the pantry for months. Once you have a bag, you need only a handful of other ingredients for the soup. My recipe for miyakuk runs pretty traditional in its flavor and is one of the versions I made for myself during those 450 plus days. And it freezes well if you want to make a big batch. Beef forms the base of miyakuk, providing a grounding backbone to an otherwise light and briny soup. You can use beef chuck, brisket, or even ground beef, and you don't need much at all. Saute the meat in toasted sesame oil and minced garlic, then add rehydrated seaweed and water. To Traditionally, the soup is seasoned with gukgongjang, literally soup soy sauce, which is lighter in both color and viscosity, but saltier in taste, than the standard soy sauce you'll find in the U.S. Give gukgongjang a try if you have access to an H Market or other Korean or Asian grocer, but if you can't find it, regular or low-sodium soy sauce works just fine. In dry form, Korean miyok are long ropes of seaweed. They are less firm than sheets of dashi kombu kelp, but firmer than seasoned seaweed snacks, and not meant to be eaten straight out of the package like those are. A little goes a long way. The strands might not look like or weigh very much, but after soaking in water, they expand like those magical bath toys in mere minutes. Using kitchen shears to cut the rehydrated miyok into bite-sized pieces is key, and a very clutch Korean mom move. Even after eating it over and over and over, I would still happily tuck into a bowl of miyokgok any night of the week. And I do. It is a deep source of comfort that will always tie me to those early days of motherhood with my daughter and remind me that I'm never too far from my own mother, even when she's thousands of miles away. Miyokgok, 4 to 6 servings. Miyokgok comes together easily with just a few ingredients. Take care to purchase the correct dried seaweed, as miyok is different from other varieties like kombu, wakame, or hijiki. 1 ounce dried miyok, 2 teaspoons toasted sesame oil, 5 garlic cloves finely chopped, 8 ounces beef stew meat, such as chuck or brisket, cut into 1/2-inch pieces, 2 teaspoons diamond crystal, or 1 1/4 teaspoon Morton kosher salt plus more, freshly ground pepper, 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon or more soy sauce, steamed rice for serving. Place miyok in a large bowl. Pour in cold water to cover and let sit 15 minutes. Drain in a mesh sieve. Using kitchen shears, cut seaweed into 1-inch pieces. You should have 2.5 to 3 cups. Heat oil in a medium Dutch oven or other heavy pot over medium. Cook garlic, stirring occasionally until fragrant, about 30 seconds. Add meat, arranging in a single layer, and season with salt and pepper. Cook undisturbed until meat is golden brown underneath, about 1 minute. Add seaweed and cook, stirring 1 minute. This is a good time to cut up the seaweed in the pot even further if you would like. Pour in 9 cups water and bring to a boil, skimming foam from surface as needed. Reduce heat, partially cover. Simmer, stirring occasionally, until seaweed is softened, beef is tender, and broth looks milky, 20 to 25 minutes. Uncover and stir soy sauce and 2 tablespoons diamond crystal or 1 1/4 teaspoon Morton kosher salt into soup. Taste and season with more soy sauce and or salt if needed. Ladle into bowls and serve with rice alongside. Na Osbrink is the deputy food editor of Bon Appetit. Rest assured, she ate a balanced diet in addition to miyokgok during those 450 days. The fourth trimester is a series where parents share the meals that nourish them postpartum. For more, head to bonappetit.com/fourth-trimester. Now I'll be reading the best new bars in America. Whether putting a spotlight on unique spirits or reinvigorating queer nightlife, these 11 bars mark a fresh and exciting shift in how we're drinking. By Bon Appetit staff and contributors. What distinguishes a great bar from a good one? Maybe it's an inspired cocktail program shaped by world travel, or a foam-walled lounge designed to immerse you in great music and dramatic drinks. In our cross-country pursuit of the best new bars in America, these 11 wildly different places stood out for a shared reason. They're immersive, conceptually unique, and driven by clear purpose. After numerous martinis, frozen cocktails, and very stiff shots, for good measure, our picks include a speakeasy blending imported teas and the eye-watering Chinese liquor baijiu above a Seattle noodle shop, and a red-lit Miami drinking den with a monster obsession and trading cards for a menu. The people behind today's best bars aren't afraid to branch out and drinking culture is so much better for it. Some bartenders are taking this moment to reinterpret historic classic cocktails, while others are charting entirely new paths. Whatever you're into, these are boom times for bar lovers. So start with one of these spots and see where the night takes you. Elazar Sontag, Restaurant Editor. Bar Kaiju, Miami. Tucked away on the mezzanine of the Citadel Food Hall in Little River is a monster's den. Bar Kaiju. Inspired by owner Derek Stillman's singular obsession with the world's many strange beasts, Kaiju in Japanese, the bar leans into the fantastical, from anime posters and projected monster movies on the walls to the 15 monster-inspired drinks printed on the trading card menu. Mechagodzilla, nemesis to the King of Monsters, takes shape here as a highball of Japanese whiskey and cherry-blossomed-infused vermouth. Meanwhile, Roden, the so-called fire demon, is embodied by a peppery margarita with a spicy lollipop finisher. Apart from the occasional whiff of pizza or jerk chicken from the food hall below, this watering hole will transport you to a mystical new world. Kate Casson. Stay Zero Proof, Los Angeles. Stay Zero Proof has all the markers of a nightlife magnet. You'll find dim, vibey lighting, impossibly pretty regulars, and enough espresso martinos to render blinking entirely optional. But something is very different. There's not a drop of liquor behind the glowing bar. These martinis are a combination of espresso syrup, foamy aquafaba, and brulee brown sugar worked up by Derek Brown, a wizard of alcohol-free mixology. Though excellent zero-proof options are now available at many of the best bars, this is LA's first entirely no-booze destination, and founders Summer Phoenix and Stacey Mann don't take that lightly. The drinks are mixed with all the seriousness found at a craft cocktail bar, tapping an apothecary's worth of herbs, shrubs, and aperitifs to achieve their complex, surprising flavors. Stay Zero Proof has a lot to say about divorcing, going out, from getting sloshed, and we should all listen. But don't let anything distract you from the main event, a legitimately great bar with cocktails you'll want to drink all night. Elazar Sontag. Birds of Paradise, Brighton, Massachusetts. Stepping into Birds of Paradise feels like entering the first-class lounge of some mythical airline. Fitting for a bar inspired by the heyday of mid-20th century travel, owner Rand Duan, who also opened nearby Blossom Bar, created the cocktails with managers Will Asaza and James Sutter. The menu is divided into two parts, the first inspired by a single location, currently Guadalajara, where Duan and Sutter recently traveled. Think cocktails like the Para de Sufrir, a vegetal martini with notes of tomatillo and soursop, or the Penes del Cielo, a drink inspired by the Mexican street food elote and featuring nixtamalized corn. The second half of the menu offers drinks that fuse influences and flavors from two destinations, Cachaca and Wasabi in the Rio to Tokyo, Rum, Vermouth, and Whey in the Kingston to Milan. A pressing question always hangs over an evening at Birds of Paradise. Where to next? Sam Stone. Super Bueno, New York. At Super Bueno, a party is always underway. The Mexican-American bar glows with moody pink light and is decorated with cactuses, the Mexican flag, a beach umbrella, and a winking piñata. When feeling joyous or particularly rowdy, bartenders and regulars bop the bar's hanging globe lights that swing like pendulums. If there's a birthday, a staff member's last day, or really anything worth drinking about, shouts break out over the din of salsa and reggaeton. Co-owner Ignacio Nacho Jimenez himself is probably passing out shots. Don't let all this playfulness give you the wrong idea. Super Bueno takes its drinks seriously. The vodka y soda is deceptively simple in name, but a thing of beauty. A highball of clarified guava puree, pasilla chili-infused vodka, and a splash of velvet falernum with a guava salt rim. It transforms the unassuming well drink into something complex and nods to Nacho's favorite childhood refresher of guava nectar. If you make it until closing at Super Bueno, you and a new friend might just end up raising a shot of mezcal. Kate Casson. Nine Bar, Chicago. To enter Nine Bar, step through the kitchen door at the takeout-only Chinese restaurant Moon Palace Express. Except there's no kitchen. Instead, you'll find Lily Wang and Joe Briglio's neon-lit, self-described Asian-ish bar. Before a remodel in 2022, this was the dining room of the original Moon Palace, a Chinatown mainstay Wang's parents purchased in 1995 and passed down to her and her partner during COVID. Though the restaurant's takeout menu is relatively unchanged from the 90s, Nine Bar is decidedly modern, a window into how the next generation is keeping the spirit of Chinatown alive while making it their own. A DJ streams hip-hop in the back corner under floating white umbrellas, and bartenders mix drinks, like a Mai Tai, fortified with an almond orgeat syrup. That sweet syrup, made with almond cookies baked at a local Chinese bakery, injects the classic drink with new life. It's one of many charming ways Nine Bar looks to the future without boxing out the past. Kate Casson. Wild Child, Shawnee, Kansas. Everything at this suburban Kansas bar is just a little bit extra. A cotton candy cloud hovers over the little storm, a riff on the rum-based hurricane. Banana-themed cocktails come in glasses resembling the fruit's peels, brown spots and all. On the rare occasion the garnish of glasswares are strained, at least one element of the drink is likely to be clarified, toasted, or otherwise tinkered with. Owner Jay Sanders' dedication to doing the most extends to a substantial zero-proof menu where classics like the Negroni and Espresso Martini feature spirits he strips of alcohol via atmospheric distillation. Consistently kind staff, warm wood paneling, and more than 50 pretty plants will make anyone feel welcome in this world of pure imagination. Emily Ferris. Equipment Room, Austin. Down some stairs and through a hallway padded with sound-absorbing foam is Austin's most exclusive new bar. Equipment Room takes its cues from Japan's jazz kisa, where patrons gather to listen to vinyl and sip cocktails. Conversation operates at a low murmur as a DJ spins from a selection of more than 1,200 records. While Equipment Room may flirt with Japanese tradition, it grounds itself in Texas. The voices of Willie Nelson, Beyoncé, and other local legends fill the room. The menu is similarly two-pronged, offering A-sides, classics including a Martinez and New York Sour, and B-sides, inspired cocktails incorporating ingredients like green plantain and aged white tea. These drinks are whisked through the room and presented with panache, a smoldering piece of Palo Santo to go along with one, a cloud of mesquite smoke enshrining another. It's easy, as all this plays out, to forget your hushed surroundings and let an audible gasp escape. Elazar Sontag. Paper Fan Cocktail Bar, Seattle. Paper Fan Cocktail Bar evokes a 1960s speakeasy in Hong Kong, right down to its obscure location above a bustling noodle shop in Capitol Hill. Draped in red velvet curtains, the 18-seat space is a tribute to co-owner Allison Deng's grandmother, Ms. Zhang, as she was known, who fell in love with an American soldier in the 1950s while selling paper fans in Hong Kong. When duty called, the soldier gave Ms. Zhang all of his money. She never learned what happened to her American love, but their tale is immortalized in this dimly lit space, adorned with ornate glass lamps and colorful paper fans. As you snack on Shin Ramen, doctored with Mapo Tofu, or tongue-tingling Mala Beef, you'll be transported out of the bustling Seattle neighborhood and to a bygone era. The game of Ming, a swirl of tangy passion fruit, jasmine green tea, baijiu, and frothy egg whites, is just one of the many unique cocktails pairing tea and baijiu. Weekend reservations are essential. Space is as fleeting as the far-off encounter that inspired this intimate hideaway. Allie Francis. Mother, San Francisco. When you sidle up to the bar at Mother, the bartender may offer a gentle but firm introduction to the space. This is a lesbian bar. Please be respectful of that. There are fewer than 50 lesbian bars left across the U.S., And though this one welcomes queer people and their friends of all stripes, it is a space for women and femmes. That's a distinction worth protecting in the middle of San Francisco's Mission District. The bar is relatively bare. With its worn wood floors, tasty but unfancy $13 cocktails, and a custom-built photo booth, the bar isn't concerned with reimagining the old-school queer dive as a stuffy cocktail lounge or trying to update the concept for a new generation. Mother does something even more exciting: revive a precious piece of community that came too close to being snuffed out. E.S. The Coral Wig, Baltimore. This moody, tropical, but decidedly not tiki lounge from Baltimore restaurateurs Lane Harlan and Matthew Pierce is a shapeshifter of the highest order. Meant to evoke the Manila officers' clubs of Harlan's mother's youth, one's experience of the meticulously curated space depends entirely on what time of day you visit. Duck in early, while the late afternoon sun still streams through amber-stained windows, and the Philippine mahogany paneled walls and hand-painted checkerboard floor glow golden. Sip an estate martini, a rum-based riff on the 90s pineapple martini, bearing the faintest kiss of Madagascar vanilla, and you'll swear you can feel a warm, salty breeze at your back. A few hours later, the tiny space goes thrillingly dark. Order something a bit more ponderous, like the aged rum-based carabao, and by the time it arrives, you'll have given up on squinting, letting a single table votive circumscribe your world for a few intimate hours. Whether you're here at happy hour or last call, you're in the capable hands of Charm City's preeminent vibesmiths, simultaneously far, far away and very much at home. Emil Stanek. The Houston Blacklight, Portland, Oregon. Do you remember ordering your first martini, perhaps overcome by the anxiety of trying to figure out whether vodka or gin was right, and if you'd get weird looks for requesting an olive and a twist? The Houston Blacklight is an antidote to that sort of solemn, prescriptive environment. Here, wrong choices don't exist, and it's never that serious. The bar's walls are painted with wonderfully odd murals of beasts and boxing matches and sexy, luxuriating horses. The drinks are every bit as quirky and upbeat. Jello shots come in rotating flavors like guava Midori or peach amaretto, and coconut pandan slushies taste like something straight out of a beach vacation. Owners Thomas and Mariah Pisha Duffley are also the brain trust behind maximalist Southeast Asian restaurants Gato Gato and Oma's Hideaway, ES. I've just run out of time, but please check back for more on-demand episodes of Bon Appetit and many other wonderful publications. Merci beaucoup.